I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast, episode 2 from Reed Clanton's return to Europe after 78 years. Just an awesome day today. Right now, it's 10 o'clock or so p.m. on June 1st in London. And we had an amazing trip across the London countryside today to a place called Bletchley Park. And for those who aren't familiar, Bletchley was a previously top secret campus located in a very small town of Milton Keynes, which is probably an hour and a half or 2 hours outside of London. And it was a top secret campus that was developed by Winston Churchill with a specific purpose of code breaking and gathering intelligence. And the ultimate goal of the campus, which originated in 1939, is when first began their work at very small level and then grew to about 10,000 strong in 1944 as the war was sort of at its peak. The goal was to crack the German Enigma code, which at the time was a unbreakable German communication system for which they sent code back and forth to one another, and it was uncrackable. And so based on the work at Bletchley Park, along with a couple very brave Polish men who also helped in the cause, along with the United States, who played a significant role in Bletchley Park, they managed to crack the code. And throughout the course of the war, the Allies had access to classified top secret information that helped us in a variety of ways throughout the course of the war. Specifically as it relates to D-Day, it helped us learn where the enemy positions were located, to plan our amphibious assault, learn where the reserve units were located and how quickly the reserve units would deploy, the panzers, so on and so forth. And experts believe that the work that was done at Bletchley Park, which virtually nobody knows about in the United States, but the work that was done at Bletchley Park potentially could have shortened the duration of World War II by 2 to 4 years. And of course, we don't know that for sure. That's speculation. And obviously, with the development of the atomic bombs, that could have all changed. But the work there was just absolutely critical. And we had the honor today of meeting a lady by the name of Betty Webb, who I've previously had the opportunity to interview on the phone in an earlier podcast episode, which you can find if you look for it. But Betty worked at Bletchley Park. She joined the ATS, which was the women's version of the army at that time. And she was recruited to work at Bletchley. She fit the profile, and she was picked out of a group and told to report to Bletchley Park. And she signed a pact of secrecy for which she was not allowed to speak until after 1975. She wasn't allowed to talk to her friends or family. Her family thought that she was working in London in a boring secretarial desk job. She wasn't able to tell her friends. She wasn't able to tell anybody. And for example, her parents never knew what she did because her parents died before 1975 when Bletchley Park was declassified. So Betty is 98 years old and Mr. Clanton is nearly 98 years old. And we just thought it would be a very powerful moment for those two to meet, which it was. And you can check out Instagram or Facebook. You can see the video. But just to see two legends, one who was on the front lines in substantial combat, landed on Omaha Beach, was part of the Battle of the Bulge, nearly died several times. And then somebody else that was on the complete other side of the war. Obviously, females weren't allowed to be on the front lines at that time. But she was working her tail off to gather as much intelligence as possible, which made its way all the way up through the Prime Minister's office, through Winston Churchill's office, over to the U.S. high command, down through the ranks, and eventually to the front lines. And there's just no telling whether or not Mr. Clanton would even be alive today without the work of Betty Webb. And to see the two together, exchanging pleasantries, talking, just having a wonderful time and enjoying being around one another was awesome. So this mini episode, it's about 40-minute or so conversation that we had today with Betty. Some of it was an interaction between Mr. Clanton and Betty. Other questions were asked by the group, and Betty told her story, talked about what happened at Bletchley Park, and then we spent the afternoon touring Bletchley Park, seeing what happened there firsthand, checking out many of the buildings, and just really understanding a very, very important aspect of the war, particularly as it relates to D-Day, because D-Day could not have and would not have been successful without a substantial intelligence gathering operation, and Bletchley Park played a huge role in that. So without further ado, enjoy this conversation with Betty Webb.
We know that Betty is an expert in gathering intelligence, so she has the complete list of all the names of our entire group. She managed to decode and gather all this intelligence ahead of time. And each book is made out to each person on the list. So thank you so much for...
Not at all. I just hope I got the names right.
That's okay. It's close enough. Doesn't matter. But we have Mr. Clanton, who you know about him. You've read yes. The emails. But this is his first journey back to Europe,
right?
UK and then Europe since World War II. And this group that we have, our purpose is to get him safely from the UK to France. And then ultimately to Belgium.
So you're going on to France?
Yes, ma'am.
Gosh.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very nice.
Yeah.
Big memory journey for you.
Yeah. Yes,
tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Oh,
right.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Are you going by ferry or
yes, train? Yes, ma'am. We're taking the ferry out of Portsmouth tomorrow morning.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna go straight into Normandy because we wanted to try to replicate as best we could his
yes of course yes. Gosh, that will be interesting, won't it?
It certainly will be. Yes.
Bit tear jerking too, I should think.
Emotional.
Well,
emotional.
Maybe.
Yeah. Well, Betty, let me tell you, this guy, you know, he landed on Omaha Beach, he fought in the Battle of the Bulge. I've known him now for a long time, and he's told me how tough he is and all these war stories and, you know, how strong he is and all those things, you know. And so we had a little ceremony a week or two ago, and he was never presented with his awards during the war.
No.
He came home from World War II, came back on a train, got off the train, they discharged him, and he hitchhiked home. And that
Hitchhiked.
Yeah.
And so a couple weeks ago, one of the military units in Texas wanted to honor him, and so they presented him with all of his awards, his Bronze Star and everything. And good God Almighty, he cried like a baby. I said, here's this big tough guy, fought all these Germans in World War II, Omaha Beach, Battle of the Bulge. They do a little ceremony for him, and he cries like a baby.
I said, what age does you?
I said, what's the deal with that, Mr. Clanton?
I don't remember that part.
I like that one.
I just remembered, I'm going to have to be excused for a minute, because one of the staff, whom I know very well, is coming down to give me some leaflets.
Oh.
And she may well be standing out there not realizing that I'm here.
Do you want us to go out?
No, no.
Okay.
No.
Take your time. Can we get you a cup of coffee, tea, anything?
I think I'd like a cold drink, actually. An orange.
Orange juice?
Whatever there is.
Orange juice?
Yeah.
Orange juice?
I'll be back.
Carolyn,
yeah.
Come on
over
here, sit over here, so you can get into the picture.
Yeah, Carolyn, come
on.
Yeah, just sit
right over there. Yeah, so
I can't get anything out of it.
You can't. You want me to take a lid off?
I wanted to drink it out of the hole, but I can't get anything out of it.
Suck on it like
a
like
like
if you change your mindset, it'd be
if you have a pencil, if you poke that hole there, it'll come out.
Oh, yeah, that's what it is. Yeah, there's a man's nose. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was
trying to find if I had a poker anywhere.
You want a straw? Like,
no, this would be fine if I can get it working.
Down below you?
Oh, yeah.
This little hole right here.
Thank you, ma'am.
Uh-huh. I don't have my pocket knife. They made me leave it home.
I don't.
Well,
Kathy, do you have a pen? A pen or pencil?
Thankfully, your tour leader is
you got a
prepared.
Pen.
Oh, there we go. Yep. You need a.
I need a hope. There, oh, here.
You need a straw.
Yeah. No.
Try that.
Let's see. Might
work. Is it sweet enough? Mm-hmm. Is that Julia? Work now?
Julia?
Good deal.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is that better?
That's better.
And it's sweet enough?
Is it working now?
It's working now.
Good man.
You just had to change your mindset.
Get the air in.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's what I was doing.
Great. You got enough sugar? Is sweet enough?
Yes, I have. Thank you, babe.
I know. I was just like...
Oh, that's the book. Yeah, all right.
Carolyn, that's yours.
Oh, thank you.
Where's Martha? There she is.
That's nice. That's nice. Yeah.
I haven't met you. I'm Sarah.
Yeah, I'm Sarah. I'm Derek.
Nice to meet you, Derek.
Yeah. I'm a friend of
Kathy. Okay. That's fine.
How lucky to be friends.
Yeah, it's fine.
Okay.
I never met you.
Pleased to meet you. Yeah. Yeah, indeed. I'm honored to meet you.
Robert, oh, what's your book?
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Kathy's... a great lady.
She's so sharp.
And I'm panning over.
Yeah, very
so sharp.
Very podcast.
Well, on Jeff's podcast.
And this is Brian.
She's
Brian's.
Very
yes, Brian's
humble
too.
As well, yeah. Which is
Brian's.
Beautiful.
Sorry.
Yeah. I'm going to go introduce myself.
I've read Jeff's letter to her.
It's amazing.
Have you heard
lovely.
From your kids?
Yes.
Melissa?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yes. Yeah. Everyone's good.
Thank you. This
is not the lady I was looking for. Carolyn, do you have some
sugar? Okay, so Jeff Wells.
Oh, you need more sugar?
Yeah, I need
some.
Is that one or two?
One.
This
is.
I'll leave you with that. I'll leave you with this.
Do you like it sweet?
No, yeah.
Coffee.
Yeah, I like
my house in a minute.
I don't like cream, but. I think that bitter coffee, I got to have a little bit of sugar.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is a passion. And Betty's on there, the Annie's woman.
Oh my gosh.
She flew to Baltimore in 1945. Oh my gosh. That's actually fine. And that was your first white ever.
Did you get all of these this last week? When at the ceremony, all of those?
At that ceremony for Sam Houston, yeah.
Because I couldn't see on the video. You know, when I was watching it.
Oh.
So it wasn't just these, but it was also the ones.
We're good editor.
Well, was it, did you get this one too?
I just wanted to make sure
all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think you can say anything you really want to.
Right. One or two more.
Can you tell the story?
Give me another one, I guess.
So, this is a bronze.
Yeah.
Have a seat.
Julia.
We're getting your orange juice. We're getting your orange juice.
Yep. Thank you.
Sorry,
that's okay.
The wrong
no, it's okay. Sorry, you got this.
No, I don't.
Thank you. Okay. I'm about to put the lid back on off.
I'm going to.
Yeah.
That's Tracy.
Is it gone?
That's Tracy. So, Betty brought this to show us. But I'm going to let her explain exactly what this is, because it's pretty cool.
Well,
and I'll pass it.
Everybody going to see it?
Well, yeah, I'll pass it around, yes. For everybody to see.
Okay.
That's all right. Thank you.
A good logistics guy would have gone and squeezed.
Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, a bit husky this morning for some reason. Too much gin.
That happens.
Well, the reason that I have that picture of the flying boat was because at the end of the war in Europe, I was detailed to go out to Washington, D.C. and work in the Pentagon. And in order to get me there, they sent me down to the south of England to get on this flying boat, Sunderland Flying Boat, which at that time was they're not used anymore, I don't think. Anyway, I went down to Poole Harbour, which is south of England, and got into a little boat, which took me out to the flying boat, And then we went on to Ireland, where we had dinner. And then from Ireland, we went to Newfoundland, Botswood. And from there, down to Baltimore. And then by train from Baltimore to Washington. And how long do you think it took?
Oh, my goodness.
No idea.
No.
22 hours altogether.
Oh, oh my God.
Wow. And you can see on that flight manifest, which Brian has right now, that there's only one woman on that flight.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And she was ill all the way. No, it was quite an experience. Of course, they don't go up very high. You can see the sea very clearly. Which didn't that add it to my fright?
Sounds terrible.
Yes, it was a bit. And because all the men on that list were not in uniform, and of course I didn't know who they were, and I wasn't at liberty to talk about what I was doing, so I sat there for 22 hours not talking to anybody, except the pilot. He came down and gave me what he hoped would make me feel better. Which didn't. any questions on that? I'm very bad at remembering what people want to know.
I'll start if it's okay. I was going to ask you if you could talk a little bit about your childhood, because you go into it in your book.
Oh,
yes. And the reason I'm asking is because Mr. Clanton had a very similar.
Oh, did you?
Childhood.
Probably. I haven't heard yours yet.
But I wanted to see if you could just talk a little bit about your childhood and what you experienced growing up and how it was during that time.
Yeah, okay. Well, I was born in 1923, and we lived in the country. No phone, no car. You walked everywhere. I expect you found the same.
Exactly,
yes.
Yeah, exactly.
But, looking back, I had an idyllic childhood. Nothing to worry about. We didn't lock doors in those days. And we lived in a house which was high up, had the most wonderful view of the countryside. It's no good mentioning names, because you won't know the local names, but it was absolutely magnificent. And apart from 3 months, I think it was, in Germany in 1937, when the Hitler regime was beginning to get rather worrying, that was the only time I'd left my country home until I joined the army, that's the Auxiliary Territorial Service, in 1941.
When you were in Germany, did you sense what was happening with the government, the unrest?
To an extent, yes. But of course, I was very young and I didn't understand the ins and outs. But I do know that the family were very worried about it. They were a very religious family, and they obviously could see more of what I couldn't see.
Sure.
And it was beginning to have its effect in the school where I went with the daughters of the house. And we had to give the salute before and after every lesson, if I remember right. So, you know, the atmosphere was tense.
And you grew up on a little bit of land, a couple acres?
Yes, a bit more than that, I think. But it was a lovely, lovely place up on the hillside, and we had pigs and poultry and bees. And it was all very different from how life is today.
And Mr. Clanton grew up in a basically a mud hut in...
Built mud out of bricks, yeah.
Built out of mud bricks in West Texas.
Gosh.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
My dad, he was kind of a carpenter, like, and he made these farms and made us kids mix mud, put straws in there to give them strength, you know.
Yeah.
And it was about this long and about this thick. And we built our house out of them. But we didn't have no money to finish the house, so we didn't have no floor in the house or windows or doors. So anything wanted to come in and come in, you know. But that's the way we live, had to live.
Well, you're looking very well on it anyway.
Yeah.
Right. And Mr. Clanton, what age did you leave home?
What age?
What age did you leave home to go go to work?
I think it was around, I was eight years old, something like that. But I'd already learned how to drive a tractor. And this other farmer over there needed a hired hand. So I went over and got me a job from driving one of his tractors.
Oh, gosh.
Paid me $60 a month.
$60 a month.
Big money, right?
Good money, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Well.
Yeah.
And he went, basically left home, dropped out of school,
Yeah. I never did get to go to school early.
Yeah, didn't have time to go to school because he had to work.
Had to work, yes.
Stuff like that. Yes.
What grade did you drop out?
Fourth grade.
I don't know if he's positive.
Fourth grade.
Yeah, I think.
Fourth grade, Mr. Clanton dropped out of school, went to work, and then went around quite a bit, spent some time out in California.
Yeah, this friend of mine, he says...
I might interrupt. A member of staff who was a friend of mine.
Oh, sure, please.
I'd like you to meet her.
Please.
She's a senior person.
Oh, wonderful.
What is her? You're right. How many... bless you. Jeff...
Hello, ma'am.
Hello.
Jeff
nice
Wells. Very nice to meet you. What was your name?
Sue.
Very nice to meet you, Sue. Thank you so much for allowing us to.
Yes. At the moment, I haven't got leaflets.
Okay.
But I will keep an eye out and to get some to you once I don't think it's going to find some change and we'll update it.
Okay.
So, but as I say, so at least that people can see if it walks here and that sort of thing. And then, are you okay there?
Yes, fine. Yes. I'm sorry about this, but it's, it's fine. Time.
Right, will you take care of yourself?
And I've got some lovely photographs of Rose's baby.
Ow!
But I haven't got them on.
No. Okay. Next time.
She'll let you have them.
Yes, she will. She will. And
okay, well, I'm having a lovely time.
Good.
Thank you.
Right, will you take care?
Yes,
enjoy the rest of the day.
Honored to meet you,
everybody.
Ma'am. Thank you for hosting us.
My friend Derek.
Yes.
Oh, so.
Right. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
Unfortunately, his wife didn't come today.
Oh,
so we were going to have a nice trip around.
Yes.
Things didn't work out.
Oh, bless.
Anyway, thank you too.
That's fine. No problem.
Very much.
Enjoy your visit, and obviously, I'll speak to you soon.
I'll see you soon.
Yeah.
Oh, how's Doris's funeral?
I haven't heard anything, but if I hear anything, I will let you know. Yes. No, that's not one I've seen. On the thing, but I'll see what I can find out. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Enjoy the rest of your trip.
Okay. Thank you, Sue.
She keeps the place together. I don't know if you've all had these maps, have you?
Maps? I think we have a couple.
Yeah, I got
them.
Okay.
You can have some more if you want them.
Thank you.
They're running it, they're reprinting the normal leaflets.
Okay.
So help yourselves anyway. Right, where were we? Sorry about that.
I was going to mention one more thing about your time in Germany. I remember it from your book, but they forced you in school. You went to school in
Germany. I did, yes.
They forced you said, to do the German salute.
Well, they tried to, but I didn't. I didn't.
Good for you.
You've got a sore arm.
Shoulder hurts.
Well, you see, I was only 14. I didn't know what I was doing.
That's at the time we didn't have the internet, you know, we didn't have TV.
Nothing like that.
We didn't have TV.
Yeah.
So if you could just tell us a little bit about Bletchley and how you came to be here. And we've talked about this before, I know, but I've told you in the United States, very few people know about Bletchley Park and what happened here and the importance of Bletchley Park, which is why I wanted all of us to come here.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
Because it played such a significant role in so many things during the war.
Well, that's wonderful. And then all of you can talk about it.
That's right.
It should spread well.
We will spread it.
Good for you. Yes, well, no, I had no idea. I'd never heard of Bletchley. And after you've done your basic military training, as you probably know, you're asked what you would like to do, be a driver or a gunner or whatever. Although, no, I don't think girls went onto the gun sites in those days. But anyway, there was a fair choice, crooks, orderlies, all that sort of thing. But I said I really didn't know, but they looked at my CV and found that I was bilingual, so sent me off on a special to a special interview in London. And at the end of it, he said, "Here's a railway warrant, get yourself to Bletchley."
Yes.
Never heard of it. Anyway, I soon discovered, because the first thing I had to do was read and sign the Official Secrets Act, which some of you may understand is a pretty formidable document. But you realize you're cut off from the rest of the world for until 1975. And that is a hell of a long time to keep quiet.
And that's when it was declassified. 1975 is when they declassified.
Yes. Okay. It was a rather frightening thing for somebody as inexperienced as I was, but there's only one thing to do, and that's say to yourself, well, that's it. You've signed it, so you don't talk to anybody, not even outside your own office.
Your own family. You couldn't talk to your family.
No. Nothing. They never knew. Because both my parents died before the before 1975.
What did they think you were doing? What did they think you were doing?
Well, I just said I was doing a boring secretarial job. But I think because my father had been in the army in the First World War, and I was wearing the intelligence corps badge, which we all did, I think he put two and two together and six. I don't know. He never asked me. But I think it's obvious for a former military man that he must have had some idea.
How did your parents feel when you, as their daughter, joined the ATS? Were okay with it? Did they try to talk you out of it?
No, they didn't. No. I remember my mother saying that, because she'd recently had one of the first mastectomy operations in Birmingham, she said, if you ever feel you want to come home, just tell them about my medical story and we'll probably get to have something like that, you know. But they never complained. And I was able to go home from time to time. I went home for my 21st birthday. Took you all day to get there, but I did.
Was there a lot of women in the ATS? Was there a lot of women?
Yes. I've forgotten the numbers, but yes. I volunteered, but the following week, conscription came in, and hundreds of women were called up.
That's equivalent to our WEF.
Yes, that's right.
Women
yes,
Army Corps.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Come on, folks, any more questions?
Let me ask you a question, if you don't mind, ma'am. Yesterday we were at the Churchill Museum, and one of the things that they said was that Churchill came up with some intelligence that Russia was going to be attacked by Germany. And apparently the Russians didn't believe it, but nonetheless that information was passed on. Were you aware of that information, or what are some of the other types of important information aware of?
Simply no. Because you see, I was very, very young, very junior, and my first job here was to register the messages which our signal men and women had taken down both in this country and abroad. And then they were fed in here at a terrific rate, something like 10,000 a day sometimes. And there was nothing in the clear. All you could see was the date. The rest of it was in groups of five letters or five figures. That's all we had at my level. That's all we had to work on. Quite simply, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
And each,
well, you answered it. It was a good answer.
Each level, this is the way I understand it at least, each hut, each area, each section of Bletchley Park had a very specific job.
Yes.
And they would do their job and their job only. And that may be
to
decode one thing, one small little thing, and then they would pass that on to their supervisor, and they would maybe consolidate a couple things, and then they would pass that on to their supervisor, and they would consolidate.
Well, that's right. I mean, the whole process was the taking down the messages by the signal people, passing it here for registration,
right.
Translation, decoding, then translation, and then obviously sorting out what was important and what wasn't, and then deciding whether the messages would go straight to Churchill or straight to commanders in the field. I mean, that's a very, very broad thing, but that is basically all the processing that had to be done.
And your second job here was to tweak those messages, wasn't it?
Yes.
To adjust the messages?
Yeah. That was in the Japanese section, quite late on. And that's why I was sent to America, to the Pentagon.
Talk about how that happened. What? Talk about exactly what you did there and how you did that.
Well, I simply paraphrased, translated, and translated messages. I didn't ever handle Japanese. It was far beyond me to do that. But that's simply it. I would be given messages which had been translated and changed the wording so that it meant exactly the same thing, but we hoped would not be recognizable as having been picked up and translated.
Mm. And when you were living here, where did you live?
Oh, to begin with, most people lived in other people's houses in the villages round about. We were bussed in as on a three-shift system until, I forgot the exact date, but later on in the war, they built a camp within walking distance for the Army and the Air Force. The Wrens were housed at Woburn Abbey. I'm trying to remember the name of the family, and I couldn't think. Anyway, it's a very high-up aristocratic family who were turned out completely, and the Wrens went in there, and they were bussed in for every shift. But for people like me who lived locally, we had a very good social life. On camp there was two professional musicians. One was a Herbert Murrell, who was a Bach expert, and he ran a Bach choir. And we had a young violinist who also was professional and ran an orchestra. We had a gramophone club, madrigal society, all sorts of things like that. And freedom, if you had a bicycle, you could cycle around the countryside. And that's the only time we were allowed to wear plain clothes.
How long did you live here?
Sorry?
How long did you live here?
From 41 till 45 when I went to America.
Hmm. Went to America.
Washington, D.C.
Washington,
yes. In the Pentagon.
There? Okay. Right.
With 32,000 other people.
Yeah.
can you describe your day on June 6th of 44?
I'm sorry, could I?
On D-Day.
D-Day.
What was your day like?
Well, obviously a great deal of rejoicing. We still had to get on with our work. I did, because I was in the Japanese section then, because we had to continue with our work. But, I mean, basically it was normal human rejoicing, and thousands of people went up to London. I did on one of the days, and the crowds were absolutely massive, dense. You didn't need to consciously walk. You were just taken along by the mass of the people.
Did there's a funny story that you tell about a boyfriend that you had. And so when you would give...
You know too much.
Well, that's when you publish a book. Betty, when you publish a book, you know.
Sorry. You don't like talking about stuff like that, do you?
We have a lot of decoders in the group, you know. A lot of us are decoders. Yeah. We have all the intelligence. So they had a standard address that they would give their family to write letters or... send letters or what have you, obviously.
Yes,
it wasn't.
I think it was Box 222, something like that.
Box 222.
It was in London, anyway.
In London. So as far as everybody that knew you, they thought you were working in London.
Yes, they did, yes.
In the intelligence side. Yeah. So tell us about your boyfriend at that time.
Well, my Canadian boyfriend.
The story of when
Canadian.
He... tried to surprise you. He tried to surprise you, and he knew your address was London. You know.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I'm sorry, I forgot.
No, that's a good story.
Yes, this was someone who was introduced through some friends of my father's in San Francisco, yes, well, I don't know exactly where we met, but he had been given this post office box number in London, not realizing it was just a post box. He thought he'd find me there.
So he came to surprise Betty, and he showed up at the post office.
Yes, that was ridiculous, but anyway, we got over that somehow. He was at Biggin Hill. He was an intelligence officer in the Air Force. Mm.
And you mentioned it was 3 8-hour shifts.
Yes.
That you worked. So 8 hours on and then 16 hours off. And you did it every day? Was it every day? Or did they
well,
give
it was 8 till 12. No, wait a minute. 8 to 4, 4 to midnight, and midnight to 8.
Okay. Mm.
I didn't always do it. It depended on workload, I think. But I didn't like the night shift. There's nothing worse than trying to stay awake during the night. Has anybody had to do that?
I think we've all had to do it one time or another.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it doesn't help one's constitution at all.
When you signed up for this, did you willingly sign up? I mean, did you want to do this, or
was
this something that you felt an obligation to do?
No, I just wanted to join up with other friends. So I was actually at a domestic science college near Shrewsbury. And because of the food shortages, I mean, the course wasn't very good. We didn't do what we normally would have done. The four of us decided we would leave midterm, which didn't please our parents very much. And I went into the AGS, and two went into the Wrens, and another one into the WAFs. I don't know what happened to the rest of the course.
Were there many, since you're all sort of here in one location for several years, were there many relationships, boyfriends, girlfriends?
Well, there weren't many men, you see.
They were all...
Because most of the men who were fit were in the field.
Right, right.
The men who were here were usually elderly people from the universities. They were the basic people here. There were one or two younger men, but then you discover that they had a medical condition which didn't allow them to be in the field.
Those were pretty lucky men, yeah. Betty. That was a good ratio.
Yes,
high target environment.
That was a good duty station.
Actually, it was a bit rough.
even the one-legged guy got a day every once in a while.
No, but we had a good social life. I mean, there were often dances and things. And then, of course, when I've forgotten how many of your countrymen came over here. I think, was it about 300? I'm sorry, I've forgotten the number.
To Bletchley?
To Bletchley.
I don't remember either.
No. Hmm. And they brought with them lots of goodies, which, of course, we hadn't seen for years. It's wonderful.
The bombing of London, was there any bombing out here?
Yes, there was. I don't think it was intentional, but one was dropped between, there's a church not far away, between the church and here. I mean, it makes sense to think that they were trying to bomb the station, train station, which is 5 minutes' walk from here. But nobody was hurt, and there's no way of knowing whether the one that fell near the church was intentional or not. But I would think it probably wasn't because of the proximity of the railway.
And how far do you live from here today?
How far are we?
50 miles.
Oh, okay.
Mm. It's not far.
An hour and a quarter.
Okay.
A good motorway.
Yeah, mainly motorway.
So you mentioned, Betty, your trip to the United States, flying to the U.S., yes. How interesting that was at the time.
Well, yes.
If you could just talk about your time in the U.S., your initial reactions when you first arrived in the U.S., what did you think? What were your initial reactions?
It's rather big.
And how old were you when you arrived in the U.S.? How old were you when you went to the United States?
Oh, gosh, 41, 22, wasn't I? Yes. Yes, it was a very, very interesting exercise for me. I loved it. I was billeted in a place called Cairo Hotel in Washington, 16th and Q, I think it was. Okay. So it was way out of, way out of the city. No, I enjoyed Washington very much. Quite a big British contingent out there. And we had a good social life as well. Very good.
Did the Americans treat you?
Yes.
Properly?
Very, very properly. Very pleasantly. American wax? Was it?
Yeah, the wax.
Wax.
Women's Auxiliary Corps.
That's right, yes. Yeah. Well, there were a lot of them in the Pentagon. And we had to be checked in every day. And sometimes I said to you, you know perfectly well who I am. Yeah, Betty, well, we've got to do it. So
that was the security when you were going into the Pentagon. Yes. Yeah.
Did you wear a uniform when you were in the States?
Yes, I did. But it was a Canadian summer uniform because our khaki was too hot for Washington. And Washington's probably, you know, very hot and sticky. So the Canadian, well, I think the that photograph was taken with me wearing the Canadian summer.
It's in here. It's in the book.
Yes.
Let's see if I can find it. Is that one? Is that one?
That's it. And then that was my boss. He's English.
And you arrived during the summertime, didn't you?
Yes, it was June.
So it was hot.
It was very hot.
Oh, it's so hot in the summer. You probably weren't ready for that.
Because you were coming from this weather that we're having today to...
Yes, a bit of a contrast.
Humidity. Brian, were you asking her about B-Day or D-Day?
D-Day.
Yes.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I didn't want to correct her. But what I was really getting at was on the day of the invasion, when the troops went from England over to France.
To Normandy.
I'm sure that was a very busy intelligence gathering day with a lot of intense pressure and stuff. And that's what I kind of wanted to get from you, is to describe that day.
Well,
did you even know that was happening? Did you know on D-Day that that was even happening?
No, okay. We didn't. Not at my level, at any rate. I mean, bearing in mind, I was very junior.
When did you find out that the Normandy invasion happened?
Well, you're going to laugh at this, but I got mumps. And I was in hospital in Northampton. Oh, this was getting
the mumps.
Oh, it's called Sod's Law. Yes.
That was planned.
You probably found out from some nurse.
Yeah.
No, it was maddening, but the thing was that, it was just one of those things. There was a lot of it going on around here, and I was one of them. And they pushed me off in an ambulance and left me in Northampton. And I didn't know what was going on. Sorry, it's a very negative answer.
We need to draft a new answer for you.
Yes, I wish you would.
You could cut the intensity with a knife.
Yes.
But that's a common theme that we'll see when we go over to Normandy as well. And it's probably, like, if you ask... If you could have somebody in the military today that was a PFC, you know, then and then now, really one of the main differences in the military is the level of knowledge that the lower level soldiers have today versus then. So in World War II, part of the struggle, as I've sat down with Mr. Clanton over the last couple of years, we've tried to piece together his journey and where he was at what time exactly, you know, and try to narrow that down. And part of the struggle is he didn't know. The soldiers at his level were never told where they were at. In many cases, they weren't told what country they were in. They were just simply, many times they weren't even briefed on the mission. They were just dropped and go take that hill or go execute this or follow orders. And in World War II, it was usually the company commander level that was in on what the full plan was. Even the lieutenants, in many cases, didn't fully understand the plan, where they were at. Certainly, they didn't have maps, they didn't have compasses, they didn't have things like that. In today's military, every single soldier down to the lowest level has a GPS. They know exactly where they're at all the time. They can see where they're going. They can see all those things. And that wasn't the case. But today, on the administrative side, on the intelligence side, it's not much different than it was what you're describing. They have these intelligence analysts, and they sit in a room in a cubicle, and they are responsible for one little thing. You know, if it's transmitting a signal or collecting a drone shot of this or whatever, and they just take that and pass it on. They don't know anything that's happening. They're not part of the mission planning. The information that they generate is a big part of the mission plan, but it's for the generals and for the higher up guys. Mm. Same today. It's no different today. Yeah. And you don't know what's going on.
Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, you couldn't you couldn't talk to everybody singly about what was going on.
It was it's quite interesting to see how it's all pieced together. But that what you just mentioned, you know, we all have this grand romantic vision of World War II at this point in time, because we look at it as Britain and the United States together saved the world, you know, and the guys that were on the ground valiantly assaulted this objective or that objective, and the folks who, like Betty, who did all the work to gather the intelligence, were masterminding this complex. It wasn't like that. It was get on the ground and go now.
Kill or be killed.
Kill or be killed. I don't know where I'm at. I don't know where I am, but I got to take that building or I'm going to die. And from your standpoint, it was, I have my job to do, and I have to do it now, and I have to do it well.
Yes.
And that's a fundamental situation, and it's part of the reason it's so hard to recreate history in this point in time, because the only guys that are still with us are the younger troops. So you don't have the strategic, you know, the generals. You don't have that perspective at this point in time. But to me, the most valuable of all the information is from those who are actually doing the work, which was Betty and Mr. Clanton, because you all were on the front lines. Another difference between today and World War II is that the officers were 50 miles back, you know, and then the guys are on the front lines doing all the hard work. So to me, those relate very closely, you know, what your story, just in different ways. But I just think it's so fascinating that you, Betty, had a little piece of information that you collected or passed on that ultimately formed into this piece of intelligence that worked its way all the way up through probably the Prime Minister's office, and then eventually it made its way over to the Eisenhower and his group, you know, Supreme Allied Command, and then that made its way down to all of the different division commanders, and then division commanders to what they called regimental commanders at the time, and then battalion commanders, and then some of that made its way down to company commanders, and some of that made its way down to platoon leaders, and then that platoon leader, Mr. Clanton, was a forward observer. He was on a forward observer artillery team, so his job was to sight the German target positions. Cannon Company is a company that each division have is this sort of medium range artillery. Because traditional artillery is, you know, for 5+ miles out, you know, long range artillery. And then you have your closer mortars and things that the guys on the ground use for close fire support. But Cannon Company was designed to have a more mobile artillery unit that could move quickly to do closer range support, say a mile or two out. So Mr. Clanton's job as a forward observer was to move ahead of the lines with the infantry, usually on the front lines, find the German positions, and then call them back to his guns, to the guys that had the guns, to shoot and destroy those targets. So he was right up there under, in many cases, ahead of the infantry, under extremely heavy fire, trying to call in the positions. So probably information that you gained at some point here at Bletchley Park as a group, that information in terms of German locations, artillery, or, you know, positions, things like that, probably some of that information eventually cycled its way down to Mr. Clanton.
Thank you. Yeah, right.
Well, the great thing is you're still here.
Yeah.
Can I ask, did you ever, I mean, obviously you're processing just hundreds of pieces of data on a regular basis. Did you ever know, like, when, like, the, oh, this is an important piece, or was it all just sort of vague, or were there times you knew, ooh, this is important?
No, at my level, I didn't know.
That's what I figured. Mm.
So, sounds a silly thing to say, but it's true, because you just couldn't discuss with anybody else in another office.
Right.
Mm. Yeah, because you couldn't even talk to the person next to you about anything. Hey. Even somebody you lived with that worked at Bletchley Park, you couldn't talk about it, right? You couldn't talk about anything.
Well, within your own office you could, but okay. not outside it, no.
So did you all ever try and put things together on your own, maybe other people? I mean, you know, like, hey, what do you know, let's figure it out?
No, I don't remember that at all. And we were very fortunate in that everyone was... true to their promise not to say anything, except on one occasion I understood lately that there were a couple of girls who were talking in a way that they shouldn't have done in public. Well, they were in the canteen, as I understand it, and we didn't see them again.
Wow. Did you ever meet Churchill?
No, I didn't. He came here just before I arrived, and so no, I never saw him. No, sadly. And then, I was just thinking, this is a bit out of line, but I have a copy of General Eisenhower's thank you letter, which he wrote to Bletchley. And when I give talks, I always read it out at the end of my.
Do you really?
Session. Yes. It's a very long one.
That's amazing. Did he ever visit here, General Eisenhower, at any point after the war or any time?
I don't think so, but he came to the Pentagon in a tank.
Oh, I remember.
Yes.
In the center of the Pentagon.
Yes, how many acres is that? I can't remember. It's pretty big.
Oh.
It's 6 or 7 acres, I think.
Yeah, it's huge. I don't know.
It is huge, yes. Mm.
And the Pentagon was built, I believe it was built before World War II, during World War II.
Yes, it was.
And so you were one of the first...
Yes.
First, folks to work there.
That's right, basically. Yes. 32,000 others.
32,000.
Yeah. Can't believe it, can you? We wonder how the cooks got on for lunch.
When you look back... It's your service and what your country's been through and what both of our countries have been through. What does it mean to you at this point, at this stage, to look back and you see, like, the D-Day anniversary is approaching, the 78th anniversary of D-Day. We're going to celebrate soon the 78th anniversary of VE Day, victory in Europe. What does that mean to you at this point?
Well, I suppose, in a word, I'm very glad that I was involved in it. May sound a funny thing to say, but it's something to be proud of, I think.
Excuse me?
Very much so. Derek is ex-army as well.
Yeah, 25 years.
Were you? Thank you.
Yeah, in the British Army. In the engineering side, we were there fixing things, so didn't do any shooting.
I was a combat engineer.
Yes.
In the Army. I was a combat engineer.
I've read a little bit about you before. Betty shared.
Another intelligence gather.
Yeah, well, you were in Afghanistan, I believe.
Iraq.
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 April is horrible, yeah.
Right.
I didn't actually do any combat. I was in Northern Ireland for 2 years. Which was a little bit dangerous.
That was very dangerous.
A little bit.
Yeah. Other than that, I was in peacetime. 12 years in Germany. Obviously, the Soviet Union was the big threat to us at that stage. And we're training the River Weser. I don't know if you've heard any things about Germany, but the River Weser was a very important landmark to stop the Russians crossing. a lot of training around that area.
Yeah.
I enjoyed every moment of it.
I'm just glad that Betty received the memo that we only allow Army guys on this tour. Because if she would have showed up with a Navy guy,
I have signed the quarter red.
Right.
And it just so happened there's a bunch of the folks here, like Tracy sitting next to you, and Mike floating around, Mike back there. Served, and we're all in the Army. We all have.
We welcome the Navy because they saved our butts.
They did save our butts. they did save our butts. As did the Air
Force. Big guns.
Senior photographed them with a child.
That's right. Yeah.
Very nice. Yeah.
Well, that's important too.
Betty's kept me informed about it.
Well, thank you for your service. I reached out to Betty a couple years ago, I think.
It must be 2 years of COVID.
Yeah, I think it was a couple years ago, and we did a little interview on the phone,
on the telephone.
And we sort of became friends over email, emailed back and forth a lot. And then when we planned this trip, I from the get-go, I told Betty, I said, next time I come over, we have to meet at some point. Yeah, so we just thought it would be perfect opportunity for all of us to get together and get to see where you worked, where you served your country. And then, again, it's very important, I think, for people to understand what happened here, what took place here.
It is, yes.
And to try to understand it, and then for Mr. Clanton to be able to see it and understand what was happening on the complete other side of the spectrum, I think, is really, really important.
Now, what are you doing about going around the whole place today?
Here. So we have a tour today at 1:30, which is going to be a guided tour of the outside, which lasts for about an hour.
Oh, good.
So up until then, which is about an hour and a half from now, we're just going to walk around a little bit, do the self-guided tours. The tour at 1:30 will not go inside any of the buildings. It'll just be like a tour of the grounds. Mm.
And you know that there's a cafe up there. If you're facing up better this way, slightly to the left, the side of the mansion, there is a canteen there.
Next to the mansion?
Next to the mansion, yes. On the left.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. A good lunch place.
There's a lake you'll see from the
Yes, map. Lovely lake. Unfortunately, the swans have gone. We think the fox got them. There used to be always two swans on the lake. Sad.
Mm. Do you come here often?
Well, not with any regularity, but I was here on Fridays, it happens. And we have a gathering we did have before COVID every year for ex-members. And not only from here, but from our... we had a lot of outstations, girls who did the signalling, and they usually come to that. But, of course, we're diminishing. It has something to do with old age.
How many veterans from Bletchley are still...
Well, we don't know for certain, because there were no records kept, and unless they come forward, we don't know. But I think at the last reunion, before COVID, were probably about 60.
No.
But that doesn't mean to say there aren't some still there, but they don't come forward.
Did you already mention what building you worked in?
Yes, I was in the mansion to begin with, which was very cozy compared with the huts, which were either terribly cold or terribly hot, and very, very primitive and very uncomfortable. So I was one of the fortunate ones. There was a major tester who was very... prolific in languages, particularly German. He had offices there, and I was lucky enough to be in one of them until I went over to what was called Block F, which has been taken down, but that was where the Japanese side of it was carried on.
Block F, as in Frank?
Sorry?
Block F, you said? Yeah. Frank? Block F, okay.
And I missed it.
Oh, I was just... I didn't hear you. I was just Block F. I was just asking.
Oh, Block, yes. It was called Block F.
Okay.
It housed everybody who was dealing with the Japanese side of things.
And I was telling the group before you came in, but all sorts of intelligence was gathered here, not just German. We had Japanese, Italian.
Yeah, that's right.
Russian, all sorts of different signals were intercepted. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. And some of it, of course, could be rubbish at times.
Betty, tell, if you could, just talk a little bit about how Bletchley was restored as a park for people to see. Talk about some of the things you've done over the years to help Bletchley Park fundraise and to make it what it is today. Because it wasn't always like this.
Oh, no. No, because after the war, we had to take everything away in the way of papers and so on. And then the post office had it for a while and rather knocked things about, I understand. It was many years before I came back here, but we did have reunions outside Bletchley, mainly in Bedford, weekend reunions. And that was where we were all encouraged to talk amongst ourselves and get the whole picture.
I see.
But before that, I had no idea about what was going on, and nobody did. But these weekend gatherings encouraged us to talk about what we'd all done, and that was how we put the picture together.
I see. And so when did they start the renovation process to open this up as a public...
I don't know exactly, but I think the post office was here for quite a few years. I can't remember exactly when.
No, it's okay.
But of course, there were a lot of gaps during COVID.
Sure.
But a great deal has been done since, and there's a new exhibition which was opened last week by Dan Snow. Well, you may not know him, but anyway, doesn't matter. That's Block A, which
Block
is.
A.
I hope you'll be taken in there, because that is, in my view, very, very good.
Okay. What other places should we definitely have to visit while we're here today? Are there any other favorite places?
Yes. You may like to see the memorial to the three Polish people who were very prominent in helping us. That's to the right of the mansion.
Okay.
Tucked away a bit, but somebody will take you, I expect. And then... 11A, that's another interesting one.
Okay.
Then there's the D-Day landing one, which is on all the time. That's well marked, you'll find that easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Make sure you take a look at that.
I understand your role, you know, it was kind of granulated. You'd get bits and pieces, and somebody else up the chain would put them all together eventually. But... And this is a really stupid question, but where did the information come from? How was it gathered, and how did it get here?
Oh, from our signal men and women who were stationed in England and all around the world, actually. That was the source.
But did it come electronically, like over a telephone line?
Either by... oh, dear, what's the word?
Telegraph?
Yes, telegraph, and by dispatch riders, some of it.
By what?
Dispatch riders.
Oh, dispatch riders.
Yes.
Yeah, motorcycles.
Mm.
So when that information came in, I guess somebody was sending it to all these different huts and all in the different places, so it all came into one place?
Yes, again, I wasn't privy to that information, but that is how they would have done it, yes.
So the range, just to add on to Brian's question, the range of any sort of communication back in World War II was very short. So we had these little signal stations attached to each unit that were out in the field. We did on the U.S. side, and I assume the British did on their side. And so these signal folks would intercept anything they could, whether it was... coded or not coded or what have you, and then they would feed it all up the chain, and then some of it would come here and it would go around. But from the communication total picture of the war, you had your tactical communication, then you had your strategic communication. So the tactical communication at the time was unsecure. So like today we use scrambled secure nets that are, you know, they jump every millisecond, and it's a coded sequence that you upload every day in your radio, and it's called a fill, and you stick a deal in your radio and you fill it and upload it, and it changes every day, so it's always a new coded, completely unbreakable signal. But back in the day on the tactical side, there was either complete radio silence, meaning during an attack or an offensive operation, it was usually complete radio silence until the attack started, and then they would start using the radios, because every single radio on the tactical side was completely traceable, no different than a police scanner today, same type of thing. So whenever there was an offensive operation, usually the tactical units keep radio silence until they started, and then they would start intercepting. The Bletchley's role is they intercepted the strategic side of the communications, which was the enigma, which was the planning side of it. And that's what happened here. So none of the tactical stuff really made its way here. You know, that was all sort of handled at the lower level units, but all the strategic stuff made its way here, regardless of how it was intercepted.
It's a big story, isn't it?
Right? It's huge. It was unbelievable. I mean, that's in some ways that we were talking earlier, Julie and I were talking, but in some ways, the technological advances during World War II were greater than any other time in our history, including today, because we had to. We had no choice.
Exactly.
If we didn't, we would have lost, and we'd be living very different lives today.
Very much.
And that concludes our conversation with Betty Webb. And I want to thank again the amazing members of our group who ask such phenomenal questions. And I want to thank Betty Webb, who, by the way, is just cute as a button and sharp as a tack to this day. She's just lovely to be around. And of course, Mr. Clanton, who is sharp as a tack, and to listen to those two talk. And unfortunately, all of it wasn't captured on camera, nor should it be. They should be allowed to have some private moments, but it was just a very powerful thing to see. And there was a point where everything just sort of stopped, and Mr. Clanton just said, "Thank you." That was it. And members of our group were literally in tears. It was just so powerful to see such a strong man who's been through so much, see somebody who fought their own battle to help him, but in a much different way. Just very, very powerful aspect of World War II, and a great way to prepare us for our journey to Normandy. It's late here in London. We'll be leaving early in the morning, driving down to the coast, and we'll be taking the boat across the English Channel, doing our best again to retrace Mr. Clanton's steps as he sailed across the English Channel in an LST and then a Higgins boat and landed on Omaha Beach almost 78 years ago. We will have much more coverage from Normandy. We have some just awesome meetings with some very important people there. We're going to do our best to bring that to you every day, if possible, as it happens. Again, there's no frills. There's no music. That's way above my pay grade. I just want to bring you as much information as we can, as many interactions as we can with the amazing folks that we're meeting on this trip. We want to try to make as many people feel like they're here with us as possible, so that we can all appreciate and understand the sacrifice that these great heroes make. Thank you all again. Thank you to all of our members of our armed forces who serve and protect us every day. If you want to follow along, we're on Facebook and Instagram, Walk Among Heroes. You can find us also on YouTube, or follow the website, www.walkamongheroes.org. And you can see all of the stuff that we're doing as we move around England and now on our way to France. Thank you. Have a great night, and we'll talk to you from France.